is up this week. Like a lot of the religions we talk about, Hinduism is made up of a wide variety of sects. So just like Christianity, just like Islam, just like Buddhism, just like Judaism, there's a huge spectrum of belief and practice within Hinduism. So if you say, in general, what do Hindus believe? The answer is, well, but there are some things that to be considered within the Hindu umbrella that are common. So I will talk about those things. And I will tell you up front that what I'm going to tell you is really just about all of my knowledge of Hinduism. I know just enough to be dangerous. So I have kind of a breadth of understanding, but not a very deep one. So being able to differentiate the sects for you is probably not something I'm going to be able to do. But all of the Hindu branches share a text called the Vedas, V-E-D-A-S, which actually means text, as the primary inspiration. The word Veda means knowledge in Sanskrit. Okay? So, Veda, knowledge in Sanskrit, which is a language that is no longer spoken, but is ancient. The Vedas are anonymous and about 5,000 years old. So they're roughly the same age as the written stories in the Torah. The Torah was finally written down and began to be shared as a written document about 5,000 years ago. That's Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. The Veda texts of Hinduism are about that old. And from about the same part of the world. Sanskrit was in what was to become Persia, which was then to become Iran. So think about that part of the world. All right. There are four Vedas. Each Veda has four parts. Four is one of the numbers in Hinduism. Like 3 and 7 and 40 are in Christianity and Judaism, four is the number in Hinduism.
How do you spell Veda again?
V-E-D-A-S.
Okay.
That's plural. Veda, singular, is just V-E-D-A.
Yeah. Thank you.
The texts basically Hinduism basically, not the texts themselves. So there are four Vedas with four parts. They are interpreted differently. And there are three main groups within Hinduism. Like within Christianity, there is Protestant, Catholic, Orthodox. In Hinduism, there are three main groups. And the distinction is roughly this. Hindus call their god Brahman, B-R-A-H-M-I-N. So in the first group, they believe that God and humanity are completely separate. That God is God and humans are humans. This is called dualism. All right? Dualism. God and humans are two different things. The second group believes that God is the whole and humanity is the parts. So each of us is a part, and as a whole, we make up God. That's called qualified non-dualism. And that's the mainstream. Okay? And then there's another group that says God and humanity are united. So basically, humans are God and God is humans. And there's no distinction between God and humans. And that is called non-dualism. So dualism, qualified non-dualism, non-dualism are the three groups. And there's a Sanskrit word for the third one. At least I think it's Sanskrit. Advaita, I think is how it's pronounced. It's A-D-V-A-I-T-A. A-D-V-A-I-T-A. You're beginning to run up against the fact that this is not a language I speak. So.
Can Christians relate to any of those three?
Not really, no. No, this is a really completely different understanding. Well, actually, that God and humanity are distinct is the Christian understanding. That God is God and we are not is... So the dualism piece is kind of the foundation of all the Abrahamic faiths, actually. God is God and we are not is kind of the thing the monotheistic religions have in common. So... the others, no, they're not really.
How do you spell Brahmin again?
B-R-A-H-M-I-N.
Thank you.
Okay, and I'm going to talk about Brahmin, so I'll pay you later. Brahmin is the highest, most exalted entity to be known, that it is possible to be known. It is the absolute. That's the Brahmin. Okay? The highest, most exalted entity that can be known. Now, if that sounds very familiar to you, it's because you've studied the writings of Saint Anselm, who wrote about the nature of God, and what he said was, God is that of which no greater can be thought. Right? Because if you could think of something greater than God, then it wouldn't be God. And that's kind of the Hindu understanding too, is the Brahman is the highest, most exalted entity to be known. The best thing you can think of is Brahman. And the goal of life is to have a pure and eternal relationship with Brahman. Does this sound familiar?
Mm-hmm.
Sounds quite a lot about what you've heard me preach about, you know, eternity in the presence of God, right? So these are now beginning to be concepts that we can relate to.
Wasn't that the same as in Buddhism?
Mm-hmm.
Except Buddhism doesn't have a God in the same sense.
Buddhism doesn't have a God in quite the same sense.
Yeah. True.
But yes, you know, the idea of here is the pure, the absolute, the best. Get close to that as you can, and the closer you get, the better you are.
Does Hinduism have a founder?
No.
Really?
Texts are 5,000 years old. You know, it's...
You said they're anonymous. There's no,
they're anonymous.
Nobody attributed.
Nobody, they're not attributed to anybody. So. Hindus believe that the universe, that is the things we can touch and feel and learn with our instruments and all of that, is a misperception of the reality that is Brahman. So even the best we can do of figuring out how the universe works, everything we can touch and feel and learn about and understand is a misperception of the reality of Brahman, of the absolute. Does that make sense? Sort of, maybe?
Maybe. Yeah. I think that you mean the realm that we're living in that we
right.
know
yes.
different from.
Right. And if you've read Plato, this is kind of the same thing as Platonic philosophy. Plato would say there is an ideal chair. And none of the physical chairs that we can touch compare with the ideal chair, but they give us an idea of what the ideal chair might be, right? That's Plato, roughly translated for, you know, Plato for dummies, right? Which is the kind I am. And the same thing with table, you know, there's an ideal table. And all of the tables that we can see participate in the concept of table, but are not the ideal table. All right? And if you want to know more, go back to philosophy. I think they have classes you can audit at UP. So it's kind of the same concept in Hinduism, that everything we can experience in the universe participates in the ideal absolute that is Brahman, but is less than.
So if you were, say, Mozart or Brahms or some amazing composer, and you were composing amazing music, that music would be somewhat akin to perfect music, but not
perfect music. That's right. And all music, however good or bad it is, participates in the reality of the perfect music.
We just aren't capable of producing
the perfect music. So that's kind of their understanding of the universe. So everything you see around you participates in the perfect, but is not the perfect. Human nature is divine. Human nature is one with Brahman in either a dualistic way, a qualified non-dualistic way, or a non-dualistic way. But we fail to realize it because we believe our own senses. So because we believe that the world that we perceive, we are not able to really realize that our nature is divine. All right. Now, this is where it gets fun. Every action, Hindus believe, has an equal and opposite reaction in the spiritual realm.
Well, that sounds like physics.
Yeah. A little bit, yes. But the in the spiritual realm is important. So every action we take has an equal but opposite reaction in the spiritual realm. This is... So every action takes... Every action creates an impression on us. And the impression our actions on us is called a sanskara. S-A-N-S-K-A-R-A. And the effect of the sanskara are cumulative until we are reunited with the Brahman. So,
what are the sanskara again?
The sanskara are the impressions that our actions create on us.
Okay.
But remember, and this is where this differentiates from the Abrahamic faiths and Buddhism. Every action you take has an opposite reaction in the spiritual world. So, think about that for a minute. If doing good has an opposite reaction in the spiritual realm, and that's creation, an act of creation has an effect of destruction in the spiritual realm. This is different than any other.
That's weird.
It is.
Doesn't make sense to me. Yeah,
yeah, and that's because this isn't our mindset. We're not Hindus. Mm-hmm. And what they believe is that gets cumulative more and more until you are reunited with the Brahman. And when you are reunited with the Brahman, then it is all erased. Now, you could argue, and there are Hindu sects that do, that in order to be more quickly reunited with the Brahman, you have to do evil, or at least not do good, in the physical realm. And that's because the universe, as we understand it, is a misperception of the Brahman. So everything you can feel and hear with your senses is a misperception of... So everything you think is right may actually be wrong.
So if I gave $1 million to St. Paul's, what will happen?
I don't actually know, but assuming that that was seen as an act of creation, there would be an equal amount of destruction in the spiritual realm that would be a samskara for you.
And you said that when you are reunited with the Brahman, the samskara are
wiped away.
Wiped away.
Because you are then able to truly perceive the reality.
Decision actions that you take are your decision, your choice. Are you also responsible for the opposite ones or just some?
No, yes, you are responsible for the opposite reaction in the spiritual realm.
You mean you're held responsible for that?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
But this is only individual. It doesn't affect the universe in general?
It doesn't affect
the evil that comes of your actions?
It depends on which branch of Hinduism you belong to.
I see.
So some of them say it's only individual. Some of them say it affects the universe. And that depends on where on the spectrum you fall. And you've now exhausted my understanding.
The Brahmin bulls come into it.
Actually, I'm not sure. I actually don't know that that the two words are connected.
Oh,
okay. Is this the religion that believes in reincarnation?
Yes. Well, so you keep coming back until you're reunited with the Brahmin, and this is the one where you can come back as things other than human. And actually, in some Hindu sects, they believe that kind of, not quite the further away you are from human, the closer you are to the Brahmin, but that the less impact you have on the universe, the closer you are to the Brahmin. Again, because every action has an equal and opposite reaction. So most of them don't go as far as bugs, but the reason that cows are sacred in India is because lots of Hindu sects believe that cows are as close to the Brahmin as you can get, that they are the reincarnated souls of people who are closest, they are the divine reincarnation, because people is the wrong word. They are the soul that is closest to reuniting with the Brahmin, because they have, at least from, 5,000 years ago understanding, the least impact on the universe. So
the less you do, the better you are.
The less you do, the better you are. Mm-hmm. Which is, we were talking about Mother Teresa last week, which is why when Mother Teresa went to Delhi and started doing all these things that she perceived as good works, they're like, hey, what are you doing?
Yeah.
You're getting in the way. You're...
So,
but that's why cows are sacred in India, which is why if you're eating true Indian cuisine, there is no beef. So, because they don't kill cows.
Are most Hindus because they're born into it, or is it by choice?
Like most religions, most people are the religion they are because they're born into it, and that's true for Hinduism too.
And so this religion is very, very, the culture is very entwined with Hinduism, right?
Yes.
As with all
religions, the way that the way that the religion gets played out is really influenced by the culture that it's a part of.
Is the caste system part of Hinduism?
Yes, the caste system in India is part of Hinduism. Hinduism found its deepest roots in India. And so when, you might remember this if you've watched, The Jewel in the Crown or any of those things about that, when India and Pakistan divided, India became the Hindu nation and Pakistan became the Muslim nation. So in India is the only nation that is majority Hindu in the modern world.
Is India currently still very religious, or is it like other countries where people are becoming non-religious, non-spiritual?
Depends on what part of India you talk about. If you talk about Delhi and the educated elite, they're really cultural Hindus in the way that people are cultural Jews or cultural Catholics or cultural Christians or, But as you get out of the city and into the more rural areas, it's still really a deeply believed and practiced religion. So, yes and. Both and.
And the caste system.
The caste system.
Purposes.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Political, mm-hmm. social,
yes.
economic.
Yes.
So that's more aligned with mm-hmm. the culture.
Yes.
The overall culture.
Right.
Than some things.
Right.
And it's still in effect?
No. It's actually against the law in India to identify yourself as a member of a caste.
Okay.
Because, like slavery and racism, mm-hmm. In the modern world, nobody any longer believes that the family you're born into determines your intrinsic worth.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure culturally it's...
Oh, yes, it's still...
I mean, like, garbage men
yes.
are not people you want your daughter to
yes,
marry.
Exactly. Yes, exactly. Yes, absolutely. And just like the class system mm-hmm. in England still exists, mm-hmm. and the class system in America still exists.
But you're saying you can move, you know,
yes.
even though you were born maybe to a
yes.
poor family, mm-hmm. you know.
Yes.
Okay, through your own efforts you can...
Right. And caste didn't have... While, like class in the United States or in England or in Europe, while class was... While wealth and class are connected, they aren't... It's not a one-to-one connection, right? So it was possible to be a wealthy untouchable. It was rare, but it was possible. And I'm not really familiar with all of the cases, but it was possible to be, you know, a wealthy untouchable. Like it was possible to be an aristocrat who had no money, right? Mm-hmm. That was, so while there was a large correlation between wealth and caste, it wasn't causation. So.
Are the Sikhs Hindus?
No. Okay. Sikhism is a completely different
okay.
religion.
Separate religion.
Separate religion.
Are fish reincarnated?
I don't know.
You would like to be a sacred fish.
I don't know.
Well, wait a minute.
I think they might be because koi are holy in some way. But I don't know the answer to that for sure, so don't quote me.
Well, then what do you eat if you don't eat fish or meat? Chickens.
Chicken, well, they eat
rice.
Fish.
A lot of Hindus are vegetarian.
But a lot of Hindus are vegetarian.
Yeah.
Didn't you say that a person, that their reincarnation allows a human to be reincarnated as a non-human?
Yes.
So therefore you would not eat anything, animals,
well,
because you might be eating your brother.
That's not entirely true.
Oh.
A lot of Hindus are vegetarian somewhat for that reason, but many Hindus eat chicken, many Hindus eat goat, many Hindus eat fish. So many Hindus eat lamb, although that's more recent because there weren't lambs and cheaper later import. So
that's contrary to a person being reincarnated as an animal.
Not necessarily. Again, you know, mm-hmm. maybe. And again, you're tapping out my knowledge here, but chicken is a huge part of mm-hmm. the diet of most Hindus. So maybe you can't be reincarnated as a chicken. I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now if I die and I become a cow, okay,
uh-huh.
and then the cow dies, then what happens?
I don't know. It depends on...
So you're so close.
Yeah, it depends. It depends on...
your ex.
Well, it depends on how good a cow you were, I guess. or how bad a cow you were. But eventually, the end is the part of the divine nature that is in you is reunited with the Brahman.
So when the cow dies, that's the end.
If you're a branch of Hinduism that holds that the cow is the highest form, then yes.
Yes, okay.
But I think only if the cow dies a natural death. I think if the cow is killed, that the cow has to
come back. Yeah.
And so that's part of the reason that there are huge fines for killing the cow.
Even though the country isn't Hindu, there's it's still a government law?
Yes.
It is?
Yeah. There are, if you, I think there, I could be wrong about this, but there used to be, anyway, a jail term associated with hitting a cow with your car and killing the cow. So, and I know that one of the things that when partition was happening, there was a lot of violence, interreligious violence. And I know one of the things that Muslim gangs did was cut the throats of cows and leave them in front of Hindu homes. Because that was seen as obscene. And the Hindus did equally obscene things to back, but that was a way to really distress Hindu people, because there are things you have to do about disposing of the blood of cows and those kinds of things. If you're of that sect. And like I said, wide, not deep.
What does it mean to be reunited with the Brahman as when you reach your ultimate goal?
Your divine nature reunites with its. The Brahman is not personal, so its would be a better pronoun. all right. This is about to get weirder. Yes. When the one, Brahman, is manifested, it must do so in pairs of opposites. So if you're going to show the Brahman manifested, it never manifests as one, but always as two, and as opposites. So male and female, sometimes white and black.
How about male and male?
No, always opposites. Male and female. So it's got to be a pair of opposites.
When you say manifested, you mean shown like as a statue?
As a statue.
Okay.
Yes. So if you go into a Hindu temple, there are statues. And usually there are six statues. Three god and goddess pairs. Okay. And one of these is the one you know, which is Krishna, which is the goddess with all the arms. Okay. And there's one you've probably seen that is a god with a head of an elephant.
Ganesh.
Yes. And I'll talk about those. But there are three god and goddess pairs to personify the three aspects of the manifest world. Creation, preservation, and destruction. All right, so there's a god and goddess pair devoted to creation. There's a god and goddess pair devoted to preservation. And there's a god and goddess pair devoted to destruction. And Hindus see all three of those aspects as equally good. So creation, preservation, and destruction are all three equally good.
Maybe because they're all going on at the same time.
Yes.
Life, you have death, you got
yes. And it is, although it's phrased differently than we do it, we're in Lent, right? And we talk about, in the midst of life, we are in death. Jesus says, unless a corn of wheat falls into the ground and dies, it abides alone. But if it dies, it brings forth much fruit. Mm-hmm. So really, this isn't too far from...
It just sounds weird as we say it.
It sounds weird as we say it, but if you think about, we talk about the persons of our Trinity sometimes as the Creator, the Redeemer, and the Sanctifier, Father, Son, Holy Spirit, but sometimes Creator, Redeemer, Sanctifier, the one who creates, the one who saves, and the one who blesses.
And the saving didn't happen until death.
Death,
which
right.
would be destructive.
Right, beating down death by death is, so it's not as far as you think it is. It just sounds different. And also, it looks different. You go into the temple and you see, what are all of those? But
even the Julia of Norwich had the male and the female as God.
Yes.
That you couldn't have one.
Have one part
the other.
Without the other. That's right. So the idea that the opposites unite to create the whole is not really alien. It's just not the way we usually think about it, right? Okay. The gods and goddesses are only aspects of the Brahman seen through, okay, this is going to be fun, the Maya, M-A-Y-A, also known as the Divine Mother, which is the Brahman's power to manifest. So you have, again, you know, pairs. You have the Brahman, and you have the Divine Mother, Maya, which is the way that the Brahman is able to manifest into the universe.
Had to be created to be seen.
Yes.
So needed a woman.
Yes, mm-hmm. Exactly right. Exactly right. So, and the gods actually have different names depending on the difference. The god and goddess pairs have different names depending on what sect you belong to. The only two that are common are Krishna, which is the female pair of preservation, and Ganesh, I think I'm saying that right, which is the male god of destruction. The other names change, but those two are common throughout the...
Do you want to spell them?
No. Yeah, yes. Krishna, K-R-I-S-H-N-A. And Ganesh, it has so many different spellings, I'm not even going to spell it for you. G-A-N-E-S-H is the phonetic. But that changed because those sounds get made by lots of letters. So,
Hare Krishna,
which you've heard of, comes from Krishna. Most Hindus would say that the Hare Krishnas are, they wouldn't use the word heretic, but their version of heretics, that they picked up pieces of Hinduism and made up their own religion. Most Hindus regard the Hare Krishnas in the same way that most Christians regard the Mormons, that, why are you using our stuff? You know, if you want to make your own religion, make your own religion, but stop using our stuff. That's kind of the attitude. So, all right. Spiritual practices. All right. The basic foundation, there aren't really a lot of spiritual practices per se. There are not a lot of things that Hindus have to do. But the concept is we seek our true nature. And our true nature is, the part of the Brahman, is infinite, unified, and unchanging. All right? Our true nature is infinite, unified, and unchanging. These attributes are connected to freedom, love, and peace, in that order. So the infinite is connected to freedom, the unified is connected to love, and the unchanging is connected to peace. But the more we get of one, the less we have of the others. So it's like when we talk about construction projects, I talk about the triangle. Good, fast, and cheap, you can have two. It's kind of the same concept. The more freedom you have, the less love and peace you have. The more peace you have, the less love and freedom you have. The more love you have, the less freedom and peace you have. So we seek our true nature, which is all three, but in this world, you have to pick. Because the more you have of one, the less you have of the others.
Can't have a balance.
Not really, no. I mean, obviously that's what everybody's striving for, but it's never attainable in this world. So basically, the spiritual practices come down to four things. Remember that your true nature is divine. So when you're, you know, struggling or whatever, remember that your true nature is divine. Accept yourself where you are and move forward. So start where you are and go from there. Choose the path that best fits your temperament and find ways to turn your activities toward the Brahman. And because the biggest obstacles to oneness with the Brahman, are forgetting the world is God in disguise and being distracted by your senses, get your senses out of the way and be mindful. So the idea is everything that you take in by your senses distracts you from oneness with the Brahman. So as much as possible, get your senses out of the way. So you will be most unified with the Brahman when you are taking in nothing through your eyes, nothing through your ears, nothing through your nose, nothing through your mouth, nothing through your sense of touch. When your senses are completely absent, you will be closest to unity with the Brahman.
Sounds like you're
Earth.
Dead then.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, like you're not doing anything.
So,
is the common sense.
So,
or you're meditating and trying.
Or you're meditating. And yoga is, in various forms, is a way to try to get your senses out of the way. But so is meditation. And that's another reason why a lot of Hindus are vegetarian, because your taste actually distracts you from oneness with the Brahman. So the more plain and simple your food can be, the better. So you obviously need to eat to live, but
you don't need to be a chef.
Right. Right. And if you know, rice is what you can do, and rice and vegetables, then the more plain you can make it, the less you take in through your sense of taste, the better. The same thing with movies and those kinds of things. And now again, this is an extreme, but the less that you take in with your senses, the more closely you are connected with the Brahman.
Like dress-wise and appearance-wise, wouldn't that be very similar to what Quakers and Shakers and those kind of denominations were in the past?
Yes. And if you go to, Hindus don't have a clergy per se. They don't have, it's not like you can be ordained a Hindu priest. But if you go to the people who the community acknowledges as closest with the Brahman, you'll see practices very similar.
They are more plain?
They are more plain.
Isn't it the Hindus that have so much gold and
that
sort of thing in
yes.
their fabrics and their
yes.
jewelry?
Yes.
So it would seem...
Is it counterintuitive? Yes,
yeah.
indeed.
So
but,
that's the opposite they're practicing
well,
to get to the plain?
Mm-hmm. Well, and kind of. But, you know, if you look at Christian life, we follow a teacher who said, sell all you have and give your money to the poor. And who has, if you read the Gospels, Jesus has more to say about the fact that the wealthier you are, the further away you are from the kingdom of God. And yet, all of our churches have silver and gold and brass and fancy fabrics and, you know, all these things. Our weddings are...
But isn't that for the glory of God rather than the glory of man?
Well,
whereas what you wear is for the glory of you.
But remember, for the Hindu, God is a part of you. So what you wear may be giving glory to the Brahman, because...
Or maybe what you wear, you have an opposite. I don't know. But yeah, well, they come together.
Be. Yes. Yeah. Maybe.
Maybe there's a.
What about the parable? One of Jesus' parable had something, I don't remember very clearly, but it has something to do with gifts, resources to two groups. One just tucked them away and did nothing, and the other had them multiply. What was the whole point of that parable?
Well, you're talking about the parable of the talents. Mm-hmm. And this is the way the parable works is the landowner, the person who owns everything, is God. Okay? So that's in the parable. The landowner is going away for a while and is entrusting to his servants pieces of his property. So to one he entrusts 10, to one he entrusts 5, and to one he entrusts 1. And the ones to whom he entrusts 5 and 10 double them. And the one to whom he entrusts 1 hides it in the ground and just gives it back to him. And when the landowner comes back, he says, well, why didn't you do something with what I gave you? That parable is about the gifts that God has given us.
Like what?
Like our life, our creativity,
okay.
Our
abilities.
Okay,
you're not talking about physical.
No, it's not about money.
Yeah.
It's about God has given you mm-hmm. All of the gifts that God has given you. Mm-hmm. He expects you to use mm-hmm. for his benefit. Mm-hmm. Remember the end of the parable. You have to give it back to mm-hmm. So basically, what you've been given, you use to bring God's kingdom.
Okay, but why is it necessarily non-physical? Why couldn't it be money?
Well, it could be money if that's been something God has given to you to use it to bring God's.
No, I mean, in the parable, why was not the intent to use
the intent? Because Jesus never talked about money that way. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, if you want to know how Jesus feels about,
I didn't mean explicitly talked about it, but maybe the implication. Why couldn't it have been implied that it could also be physical, like money, but for the glory of God?
Because Jesus was really pretty clear mm-hmm. that physical wealth got in the way.
Oh, okay.
In all of his teachings, so mm-hmm. so it would be odd. Let me put it this way: for him to use it that way.
Having grown up mm-hmm. many years in the fundamentalist church, okay. the very simple, I always thought that the simpler the church, the closer they were with God. So mm-hmm. it took me a long time to get to one that mm-hmm. had more things mm-hmm. stuff. Mm-hmm. But then, having read the description of what God wanted.
In the temple?
The temple to be, mm-hmm. you know, where we have gold here and jewels mm-hmm. here and all that mm-hmm. stuff. That was pretty hard to reconcile.
Well, remember that when you talk about the description of the temple in the Old Testament and the teachings of Jesus, you're about 3,000 years apart. All right? So that's the first piece. So when God is building the temple, his people and instructing them to build the temple, and it's actually not the temple you get the description of, it's the tent of worship that goes with them. When God is giving those instructions, his people are about to enter and try to take control of the promised land. And so in that time, the richer your God's tent was, the more powerful your God was. So what he wants the people to show to the surrounding nations is, our God is powerful. See how powerful our God is. Also, he wants the people to, they've just come out of Egypt where they've taken all this spoils from the Egyptians. He wants them to give them to the glory of God rather than hold on to them and have wealth distinctions among themselves. So, but the real piece is, we're about to head into this alien land. I want you to demonstrate to the nations that your God is powerful. Mm-hmm. So 3,000 years later, when we get to Jesus, remember, and if you've come here a long time, you've heard me say, God is always moving us in the direction of, he wants us to go. So by the time we get to Jesus, nobody believes that the bigger temple, well, the Romans do, but nobody else believes that the bigger your temple is, the more fancy your temple is, the more powerful your God is. That's not how God works. So Jesus is getting the people ready to move the next step, which is God doesn't really care so much about, and if you look back in the Psalms particularly, but also in the prophets, God's pretty clear he doesn't care about our stuff, but it takes us a while to get there.
He says to that one young man,
sell all you have, follow me.
So we've sort of lost that in the translation.
Yes. Well, and it's every religion loses it. You know, almost every religion holds that those who are closest to God are those who care the least about how they seem to the world, about worldly goods, worldly pleasures, worldly things, right? And that's great, except it's really hard to live with. And so it kind of comes down to that Hindu concept of start where you are and do the best you can, right? Start where you are and move forward.
It's kind of contrary also to the fact, especially Catholics have built the humongous, big, elaborate cathedrals to the glory of God.
Right.
And yet, is that something God would have wanted them to
do? Well, and the Episcopalians and Presbyterians have great big churches too, and, you know, Orthodox certainly. And that, it kind of flies back to, well, yes, we're going to build this to the glory of God so that everybody, and it's kind of a throwback to the sense of, if everybody sees this cathedral, they'll realize
how significant,
how important God is, and how powerful God is. So our buildings should represent the power of God, very, very much in the Old Testament tradition of, well, we want to show that our God is the best. Even if there's, you know, even particularly when the cathedrals are being built, there's no other God in our world to...
That must be a human...
It's a human thing.
...concept, because that's how governments are, too. Mm-hmm. The fancier your palace, the fancier your government buildings, the more powerful, the more astute you must be.
And it's the use that you put to things, because according to the parable, there's nothing wrong with making the money.
Right, right.
Increasing it.
Right. Although, the heresy is, well, but if I have more money, God must have blessed me more, which is, feels very comforting.
So is that where, to whom much is given, much is expected?
That's exactly where that comes from. To whom much has been given, much will be required.
Now, is that in terms of physical things or talents?
Both.
Probably both.
Okay, that's what I thought, but...
Yeah.
That scriptural, did somebody else say that?
It's actually in the parable. To whom much is given, much will be expected.
In the same parable we were talking about before?
Yeah. It's also actually in the, when God is dividing up the land among the tribes, the more land a tribe gets, the more they're expected to give to the temple. So that idea of the more you've been given, the more you have to give back. Is
that the idea in Judaism too?
Oh, yes. Yes. And Islam.
And I think it's if money becomes like a god to you.
Right.
If your whole being is making more money. And, you know, having money.
Right.
Being able to still give your attention to.
Yeah. It really depends on what your heart and your mind is.
That's how I interpret it.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, if you're trying to make money just
that's
for
all you do,
the money's sake and to be more powerful and
not worry about
an image of control.
Yeah.
That's right.
You
know,
how
to
use it.
Yeah. That's right. And it comes back to, in Christian understanding, all sin is putting yourself or something else in the place that belongs to God. Mm-hmm. So if you've put money in the place that belongs to God in your life, there's sin.
Yeah. You have another God.
You have a God before me.
That's right.
You have a God before me. When Jesus, you know, when God says to his people, I am the Lord your God, you shall have no other gods before me.
That's what he means.
That's what he means. Yeah. I mean, not just that you won't make statues that you worship other than me. It's nothing else is more important. And that, to bring us back to Hinduism as I end, that concept of God is the most important, the best, the highest, the goal, is we see in Buddhism and Hinduism and...
Especially in this one, like that's your focus and you are not... It almost sounds like standing still is okay here.
Yes. So where you don't really have to worry about other people. You can just sort of let yourself think and meditate. And
connect. The more you connect
to the works. I mean, doesn't. Yeah.
And I've used the term theological anthropology before, the sense of what is the nature of humanity, right? When we talk about particularly more Protestant and fundamentalist Christian religions who talk about the fallen nature of humanity, that we can't be good on our own, that's a low theological anthropology. The idea that we can connect with the divine or even have pieces of the divine within us, that our nature is ultimately divine, is a high theological anthropology. Hinduism has a very high theological anthropology. Human nature is divine. It is the world that separates us from that. So it's in that spectrum.
Is that in our Christian, is our soul supposed to be divine, or is it still human? We would hope one day it'd be divine.
In Christian theology, the human soul is human. It is not divine. It is not a part of God. It is created by God. We are a created people.
We're also called brothers.
We are called brothers, and we're created in the image of God. But we are not created God.
There's no divine in us.
No, there's a reflection of the divine, but not pieces of the divine. God is God, and we are not. And that's, you know.
Are there a lot of Hindu temples in this area, especially in East Amherst? Do the Hindus, are they required to go to these temples?
No. There are almost no required Hindu practices. Now, within sects, that varies a little bit, but really, Hinduism is not like basically other religions in that you can be a perfectly good Hindu making progress to reuniting with Brahman without ever setting foot in a temple or really talking to anybody about your spiritual journey.
Do they have services at the temple?
Sometimes. Depends on the branch.
Resemble ours?
No.
I'm thinking more about instruction. They just know this, or they are...
Oh, no, there's lots of teaching about the Vedas. There's lots of teaching about the Vedas, but again, it's your choice whether you participate in that or not. And again, everything in the created world is a distraction from the Brahman. So they walk a really fine balance between, well, here, let's study the texts, but in studying the texts, you are distracting yourself from the Brahman that is within you. So
there's no seminary.
No, not really. There's no such thing as a Hindu seminary.
Isn't that like the yogas? What did they call the, like a house of yoga? A yoga.
An ashram.
Yes. And so you kind of line yourself up with the yoga that you...
Yes, you find somebody who you think is doing it right, and you go and learn from them.
Yes.
And that's where yoga came from?
Yes.
And that's what yoga is, meditative.
Yeah. And so there are no priests, equivalents to priests
no,
or ministers?
There's only teachers. There's nobody stands between you and God.
Mm-hmm. So what does guru mean?
Teacher.
Teacher?
Mm-hmm. So okay. It's like rabbi.
So it's not,
So. And a guru is just somebody that a lot of people have said, oh, look, they might be doing it right.
Mm-hmm. Maybe they dedicate their lives to this.
Oh, so okay. Is ashram part of that?
Yes and no. Yes and no. Because yoga is also cultural. So a lot of the ashrams are explicitly Hindu, but it's not necessary. But yoga is not necessary. While it came out of Hinduism, and a lot of its practices are based in Hindu philosophy, it is possible to do yoga with the focus being something other than the divine within you. So there are groups that do Christian yoga where the focus isn't connecting with the divine within you. It's connecting with
The Western yoga changed yoga.
Yes. As yoga moved into the West. And then there's completely secular yoga that is just all about mindfulness. Exercise. And, you know. But all yoga has a you're to focus.
Yes.
And
your inner self.
On your inner self.
And balance.
And balance, yeah. So as yoga moved to the West, it's separated from where it started.
Yeah.
We're really good at that. We appropriate other people's culture.
It's amazing to me how these different religions started. So many years ago, they were separate. Mm-hmm. Yet there is some belief in the divine, mm-hmm. the belief in that there's another mm-hmm. world.
So there must be a human
nature.
Nature.
Maybe it's human nature.
In need.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes. Or if I'm being a theologian, it's God revealing God's self mm-hmm. yeah. in a variety of ways as people were able to hear him.
Yes, mm-hmm. yes. Mm-hmm.
So, because I'm a theologian, I kind of need to end with that. You know. You know. All right? Okay, next week we're going to talk about Mormonism. So
the We That Are Way will be
in. Yeah, I'll get the podcast up.
Well, okay.
So,
yep. I was going to say,